Who's going to be arguing for whom, Mr. Freeze? You wish to reserve any time for rebuttal, sir?
I would, sir. I'd like 2 minutes, please.
Okay, 2 minutes. All right, you may begin when you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Frank Friedman, representing Mark Gobble. Mike Gardner is with me at counsel's table. This is a case about what it means to cohabit with another person in a relationship analogous to marriage for a year or more. The analogous to marriage language was added to Virginia Code 20-109A in 1997, and as the Supreme Court said in Luttrell versus Cuco, the analogous language was added to sort of stop recipients from support from gaming the system.
Counsel, let me ask you sort of a preliminary question.
Sure.
Here. Your client asserts that his former wife was living in a situation analogous to marriage, so he would bear the burden of proof for establishing that. Isn't that right?
Yes.
And what is your understanding of what the burden of proof would be?
We believe it's a preponderance of the evidence. But regardless of what it is, we're sort of in the situation where we're arguing that, truthfully, there's some quibbling about little things that are happening, but the main facts that are determinative here that we really think decide this aren't really disputed. We think this is a case like Stroud, like Luttrell and Schwieder, that the court just got it wrong. If you look at the factors the right way, they got it wrong.
Mr. Friedman, to follow up on Judge O'Brien's question, is this a factual finding to which we give deference to the trial court?
It can be if the answer basically is no. We think this is like Luttrell. Generally, it is if there are a bunch of disputed facts.
We don't decide that issue de novo, do we?
In Luttrell, in Schwieder, in Stroud, you did. You looked at the facts and you said, hey, nobody could reach a different conclusion.
But that was basically the court abused its discretion because no reasonable trier.
Correct. That's sort of level A. There's a level B also, and I'll hop to it. There are some findings that the court, we believe, and just got wrong. And they're factually wrong, and we do have the burden of showing that.
Well, before we get to the Pellegrin factors, which I think is where you're going, it's not cohabitation under the terms of the contract. It's habitual cohabitation, correct?
It is.
In the light most favorable to her, can the private investigator's testimony be read as supporting the conclusion that, based on what he actually observed, her life partner was there less than half the nights that he conducted surveillance? And doesn't that give an inference that it's not habitual?
We think not, and we think for a couple of reasons. And this is a complicated case, and I am going to get to the factors, but I'm also going to answer your question. The judge found, page 168, 22 nights of those 36 or so, 38, that there was. They're arguing, if you didn't stay there the whole night after all the lights went out, there's only five. The judge didn't find that at JA 168. He's there all the time, and he admits he's there all the time. He says in several places, I'm there 7 nights a week. But also, when he leaves, and there's no case like this, he steps 30 seconds away. It's like a man cave, at least from 2013 on. He's just stepping across the way. And so residence...
It's a separate residence with its own bath, kitchen, et cetera.
It's a connected residence, though, connected by a path. They make a big fuss about connected by a labor of love, and it's one space, and one of the spaces doesn't have the internet. It doesn't have cable. You can't go down to the man cave and watch football there because there's no cable.
That's a terrible man.
Well, that's right. And as far as working goes, because there's a picture of his office in 1288, he's got his home office in her, in the main house. And it's an elaborate, there's all kinds of stuff.
And isn't though the determining issue in this case whether they share that common residence? Because we made it pretty clear in Cranwell that that is a predicate, that's a requirement for cohabitation.
Again, and I'm aware that you wrote Cranwell, and I'm embracing Cranwell because it says, are you set up for living or for visiting? And they have this shared space. They're living every day. Everything they've done is set up for a life there. And there's almost no denying that.
But I mean, my point is all of the factors that you've mentioned, the commitment, the engaging in what would otherwise be considered marital relations and such, all of those are subservient to the main question of whether it's a common residence, because without that, we don't need to even get into the other issues.
Well, I wouldn't say it's subservient, because I think that the factors, I think what Penrod says is look to no one factor in isolation, and they're all kind of related. And the intimacy and the permanency and the financial interdependency and the sharing a common residence are the four factors. And the court got two of those factors dead wrong. They concede at page 24 of their brief it's intimate and permanent. And I'm not sure how they can recover under Penrod from that. And they say this basically at footnote 160.
If you're right on that, does that require simply a remand to apply the correct standard?
And that's where I was getting to two steps. That does require a remand. We're hoping under Luttrell and Stroud that we win as a matter of law, because we really don't think, when we look at what actually happened here, that there's any doubt that from 2013 and certainly from 2014 to 2015, they were really cohabiting in this house.
Well, part of the argument here, it seems, at least from your briefing, part of the reasoning of the trial judge that excited you or inflamed you a little bit was the concept of avoidance versus evasion, from the tax analogy he drew of avoidance versus evasion. There's some level of technical I'm allowed to go up to the line in any contract situation. For instance, it's habitual cohabitation for a year. If, hypothetically, you have a case where you prove it's happened for 364 consecutive days, you still lose, right?
364, I would say yes. But it's also not, again, they're in a shared space. They're in a compound. They're in, connected by the labor of love. You can see this path from satellite imagery. It's in the record. But let's look at the relationship. Okay? They admit that it's intimate and permanent. The judge makes the factual finding they're not sharing finances. Well, it's just plainly wrong. They share expenses, and they say without keeping score. That's their phrase. We don't keep score. J475, 595, 596. They take trips all over the world. There's a list at 1251 to 1255. They share groceries in quotes, but she pays $15,000, $12,000 of it. The same. She's buying all the utilities until 2016 when everything changes. She's getting the groceries. She's getting the cable and the internet. She's paying for the vacations. Mr. Howard's office, home office, computer, books, magazines on the table is in her house. Again, 1288. And she's given him all kinds of money from 2013 to 2015. But here's the main thing. In their daily lives, he does most of the cooking. He's doing yard work, painting, gutters, landscaping. And he has clothes and shoes there. But he has a closet full of clothes there in Ms. Elmore's master bedroom from February 2014 to August 2015. They're photographed there at 1486, 87, and 1266, 67. That's over a year, and he says at JA 831, yeah, I used to keep my clothes there, but I don't anymore, because they did. They changed in 2016. Now, in 2012 to 2013, he has free access to the house. He says he's there every day when he lives in a nearby apartment. That's at JA 823. And he sleeps at Ms. Elmore's place, he says, up to 7 days a week, JA 557. In November 2013, he buys the contiguous house.
Does the trial court have to believe that?
The trial court...
I understand that's an unusual question.
I understand your question, too. I don't think... Let me say this. Once he buys the new place, he says, again, at JA 845, I still sleep there 1 to 2 to 7 nights.
Well, if she had said it, she can't rise any higher.
But
the trial court's free to disbelieve him all it wants to, right?
But at JA 845, that's what he says. Twice he says, I'm there 7 days a week. Now, here's what happens, and here's the answer to your question. I'm sorry, I just had to get that out. The court, and this is one of our main beefs here, the court at pages 180 and 178 says, look, I'm most concerned with the last 2 years because they change everything up in 2016. And he says, you know, the last 2 years outweighs past practice. That's at page 180. It's sort of in the wind-up paragraph. And that's what's wrong. He basically doesn't say, I don't believe it or I do believe it. He says it doesn't matter. Also, when most people leave somebody's house, it's not 30 seconds away. Again, they concede that. It's just a hop and a skip away. So, again, what do we find? We find that the court is saying, let's look at the last 2 years, and that's not what the statute says. The statute says, is there 1 year? And we would say when those clothes were there, that's 16 months, really from 2013 to 2015.
As you bring up the statute, I had a question about that statute as well as the agreement. The statute requires this to be proven, established by clear and convincing evidence. You mentioned earlier that you think it's preponderance. The agreement is silent as to what burden of proof might be involved. Why shouldn't we apply the statutory clear and convincing standard when it's obvious that the language parrots that of the statute?
O'Hara versus O'Hara.
But in O'Hara, the property settlement agreement did not allude to the statute. In this case, the property settlement agreement alludes to the statute.
Well, I think what was said, and it alluded to the statute, but it took specified language and not that language.
But it says pursuant to Virginia Code Section 2109. And pursuant to, in my estimation, means in accordance with or as set out in. It means that the language of the statute is incorporated then into the agreement.
Well, we embraced O'Hara, and we think O'Hara is right. The truth is, under the Luttrell argument, under the Stroud argument, we think the court was just plainly wrong, so the standard, I mean, we are left...
For you to win as a matter of law, it doesn't matter what standard it is, because if anybody could have found
for,
that it wasn't
correct.
Obvious, you lose.
Yes, sir. For us to win as a matter of law, that's exactly correct. For it to be remanded because the court, clearly they've conceded, blew two of the factors, that would be a relevant question.
You are into your rebuttal. You're free to continue or reserve if you wish.
I want to close with one quick comment. In 2016, they changed a lot of what they did, and that's what the judge looked at. And what they did, Mr. Howard quit wearing his ring. There are photos of him wearing that ring all the rest of the time, not at trial, not after 2016. Suddenly, they decreased overnights. He said twice, he said, I was there 7 nights a week, JA 557, JA 845. Then suddenly, not there after Mr. Gobble tells them, I'm going to come in and do this, make this motion. Part of it was the CPAP. He cleaned out the closet. The wife started locking the door. Mr. Howard got the internet. No more toiletries. He said, I used to keep my clothes there, JA 831, I stopped. These superficial changes shouldn't affect anything. They really shouldn't. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court. My name is Jay O'Keefe, and I represent Catherine Elmore, who prevailed below. And for reasons that I think the court's keyed in on, it's crucially important that she prevailed below because we're here to discuss a question of fact, whether these parties were habitually cohabiting in a relationship analogous to marriage for a year or more, and specifically were they sharing a common residence? Because that's the threshold inquiry. And if we don't get past that, as we know from Cranwell, we're not even talking about the rest of this stuff. Now, Mr. Gobble argues that what we have here is essentially an uncontested factual record with a little bit of quibbling along the edges. That is completely wrong, Your Honors. The parties disagree, and the evidence is disputed about facts central to the trial court's key determination about common residence and also about financial support. Setting aside,
if this were, say, an enclosed walkway, heated and air conditioned, would you agree that those two houses would then become a common residence?
If the houses were structurally connected in that way, I don't know that I would agree that the parties shared a common residence, because you could have an apartment building that's structurally connected that same way. But
if you have adjoining apartments and you knock a hole in the wall and put a door there, that's a common residence, isn't it?
If the parties had adjoining apartments in the same complex, shared a wall and knocked a hole in it, I'll give you a common residence.
Somewhere between the coast-to-coast relationship in Cranwell and the apartment with a door between them.
Exactly, Your Honor. And I think that showing the trial court the deference that we need to on a question of fact, given the record as it is.
Let's ask a question, because it's been argued that the trial court applied an incorrect standard and that you've conceded that he missed two of the factors from Pellegrin completely. Now, I know if we resolve the cohabitation question, we might not get to all of the Pellegrin factors. Do you agree that the trial court misapplied the Pellegrin factors, that two of them are indisputably met?
I don't agree that the trial court misapplied the standard. We don't dispute that the parties shared an intimate relationship, and there's no disputing that they were together for 10 years. That doesn't matter in this case, because you need to share a common residence, or by definition, you're not cohabiting.
And I ask questions about the technicalities of the agreement. 364 days isn't a year, but and it's an unpublished case, and I don't expect you to know it off the top of your head, but in Klein versus Klein, Judge Frank for the court noted that every marital agreement comes with an implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. Some of this looks like it may not be good faith and fair dealing. I mean, when I hear analogous to marriage and hear vows and exchange of rings and the celebration of the anniversary, that sure sounds analogous to marriage, in that we're just intentionally not crossing the final line to make sure that the payments continue. Would that violate potentially a covenant of implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing? And if not, why not?
It doesn't, Your Honor, because the trial court heard all that evidence and specifically found that the parties were acting in good faith, and specifically cautioned counsel against trying to pillory either of the parties. He found that they were both being honest with him. So the trial court heard all that evidence and was unmoved by the notion that the parties are acting in bad faith to play games with the agreement.
Did the trial court simply choose to overlook the deletion of the text messages? I mean, that sounds pretty close to spoliation to me.
The trial court didn't simply overlook it, Your Honor. The trial court correctly applied the law of spoliation, which would have required Mr. Gobble to show a deliberate intent to deprive him of evidence that would be material in litigation and also prejudice.
Without a confession, how would one do that, given the circumstances here?
Well, how would one show a deliberate intent to mm-hmm. you would have to show that these texts would somehow be material to a question he has to prove and not merely cumulative of evidence that we've already had. And the trial court made it very clear repeatedly that he was going to let the parties put on whatever evidence they wanted about the fact of this relationship. And again, the crux of his opinion is his finding on common residence, and there's not going to be anything in those text messages that's going to override 22 months of surveillance and photographs when Mr. Gobble came into the house without permission. I mean, we know what the parties are doing.
Do you agree that the trial court focused on and gave more credence to the arrangement at the time of trial or shortly after the filing, after the restaurant notification that, ha-ha, I'm moving for this, over what had happened before?
No, I don't, because, Your Honor, if you read what the trial court actually said, he said he finds that the evidence of the couple's habits over the past years, in addition to the other factors enumerated, overrides what Mr. Gobble was hypothesizing.
If evidence established all the elements of cohabitation for a period of 5 years, the claim is brought to enforce the provision saying support can stop. They stop completely cohabiting by the time of trial and have it for a year. You know, it takes a year for it to work through. Is he still in, would, with this agreement, would he still be entitled to relief if the evidence shows that for 5 years it was continuous cohabitation, meets all the criteria, but at the time of trial they're no longer doing that?
Yes, Your Honor, he would be entitled to relief. I do want to point out some of the crucial factual disputes because, again, if we're looking at the evidence and the record in the light most favorable to Ms. Elmore, then let's talk about the amount of time that that Mr. Howard spent at her house. We've heard repeatedly that he confessed to being there 7 nights a week. Not true. Ms. Elmore testified that he spent never more than half the time there in a week, in a month, in a year. That's JA 983, 985. The quotes that we've heard a couple times from Mr. Gobble, I was there 7 nights a week, actually what he said is the most time I ever spent there was 7 nights a week, JA 557, and that he would spend between 1 or 2 nights a week and 7 nights a week, JA 845. Looking at that evidence in the light most favorable to Ms. Elmore, we're there never more than half the time, 1 or 2 nights a week up to 7, but we're not confessing that they were there 7 nights a week until 2016, and then we flip totally. The number of meals they spend together. Mr. Gobble says they eat together every day, 25 meals a month. The evidence light most favorable to Ms. Elmore, 2 to 3 meals a week. So what is that, a third as much? That's JA 415. Whether Howard stopped spending time over there in a bad faith effort to cloak his conduct or because of medical reasons?
Well, let me ask you this question then. You said the trial judge found that don't pillory anybody, everybody told the truth. If we have absolutely conflicting testimony from Mr. Howard and Ms. Elmore regarding how many times they ate, how can the trial court have believed everybody?
Well, I don't think we have absolutely conflicting testimony. If you say between 1 and 2 nights a week and the most ever was 7, and she says he's never there more than half the time, I mean, well, it's he has a string of 7 days, but overall he's never there.
25 meals versus 2 to 3 a week.
Well, then you have two people estimating, and you go with light most favorable to the prevailing party below. The trial court gets to pick.
Well, right. The trial court gets to pick. Both of them can't be right, and the trial court said, I believed everybody.
No. The trial court said, I believe Ms. Elmore, and I believe Mr. Gobble. The trial court doesn't say, I believe every single witness. Whether Howard maintained an office, the testimony was that he kept his computer there while he's painting, but he did his work elsewhere. That's JA 569 to 70, JA 868. The dates of pictures showing his belongings, right? This is their key thing. He's there for more than a year. The testimony is that he stayed there for, you know, while he's painting his closet. They have pictures from February and March 2014, and then again August 2015. Evidence in the light most favorable to the prevailing party below, he stayed there when he said he stayed there. There are clothes in the closets on these discrete dates, but it doesn't necessarily imply that every single day in between it looked exactly the same. Again, we're talking about basic facts that underlie the court's determination. We can't say they're quibbles, we can't brush them away, and we can't look at them in the light most favorable to Mr. Gobble. The record supports the findings that the trial court made, and that's all the court needs to affirm, especially in a case like this one where common residence is a threshold factor. By definition, if we're not sharing a common residence, we can't be habitually cohabitating, and so it doesn't matter. The theme of the opening brief is twofold. One is don't believe her evidence. She's lying, and she changed everything at the start of litigation. The trial court rejected that theory. The second part of the theme is that their relationship is analogous to marriage. But unless they're habitually cohabitating in a relationship analogous to marriage, that doesn't matter. They can Facebook in a way that's analogous to marriage. They can vacation in a way that's analogous to marriage. The question is, are they habitually cohabiting?
But and I'm having trouble with these two residents effectively being a common residence. They are close together. They clearly intended for there to be common traffic between the two. They put in their little walkway. It sure looks like effectively a common residence. Some clothes stored here, some clothes stored there. I don't know that common residence has to mean the same four walls.
Well, even if we don't need the same four walls, we need people sharing the upkeep, the utilities, the insurance, the landscaping costs, the maintenance expenses. The painting of both houses?
Wouldn't that be upkeep?
That would be upkeep, and the trial court found that Mr. Howard helped with some aspects of upkeep, but not the aspects of upkeep that you would expect a spouse to help out with.
Are they separate parcels of real property?
They're separate parcels owned by different people. Mr. Howard and his mother own one parcel, and Ms. Elmore owns another.
So in terms of property taxes, they each have individual responsibility on that?
That's right. The same with utilities and all other property-related expenses. Where they get their mail is separate. They don't pick up each other's prescriptions. Mr. Howard doesn't have glasses or a cell phone charger at Ms. Elmore's house. It's not set up for living. He does his work elsewhere, he testified. If you combine the two contiguous parcels and assume that everything in his house plus everything in her house it counts to the equation, then the two separate parcels taken together are set up for living. But you can do that with any two separate parcels. That doesn't mean that they're a common residence. And the fact that they're next to each other, I mean, Ms. Elmore did not engineer her neighbor's divorce to make all this happen. The house came on the market, and Mr. Howard and his mother bought it.
But doesn't the geography of it make it a closer question than if the house were 3 miles away?
Absolutely, it does, Your Honor. But it's still a close question, and it's one that's committed to the trial court. He heard the evidence. He made the fact findings. The fact findings have support in the record. Even if Mr. Friedman or I might disagree standing here looking at the transcript about where we'd wind up, if there's factual support in the record that can ground those conclusions, they have to survive on appeal. Your Honor, I think the court understands our other positions on the burden of proof. The financial support is laid out in our brief. Unless the court has further questions, I think. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Friedman, you've got a little bit of rebuttal left.
I welcome a lot of questions, but there are a few things I would like to spit out real fast. One is, this is their brief. Page 24, Elmore does not dispute that she and Howard are in a committed, intimate relationship. Those are two factors the judge found they didn't exist. They just admitted proximity matters. The judge said it didn't, and that's crazy, and that's at J179. It has to be a factor because he's just stepping across a pathway. Page 180, y'all were asking about spoliation. Page 180, why does the judge say it doesn't matter? He says, any amount of messages or text wouldn't have mattered. Why? Because the court finds that the evidence of the habits over the last 2 years, in addition to the other factors above, would outweigh that past practice. Now, we never said he was there 7 days a week to sleep, but he was there about 7 days a week to live. They were set up for living. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you for your argument. We're Greek Council.
Thank you.
And the next case we have is Trent versus Commonwealth.